attachment towards these thoughts. I saw how I tended to dive into these thoughts to the point that this hypothetical situation felt like a reality to me. I watched how I made plans and interacted with people within my thought, even though none of it was real, but my attachment to them made them feel real. However, whilst these thoughts felt like a reality, I always had this feeling that they were just thoughts. Throughout my meditation, this feeling grew, and the more it grew, the more my thoughts began to fade. At one point, the thoughts kept going through my mind, but I just looked at them. I didn't know what was within those thoughts. I just knew they were thoughts that went through my mind. During this time, my mindfulness shifted its focus onto other things like my breathing, and I was fine with that. Then slowly opened my eyes and came out of meditation, feeling somewhat peaceful and sleepy at the same time. Theruvan Saranai, Onaya. That's the end of the report, Bhante.
So it's great to have a report from 17 years old and correctly dealing with handling the thoughts. That means knowing they are started in a conceptual basis, and if you are not mindful, ultimately appear like reality. But if you are mindful, the concept becomes reality slowly, slowly. So you can control. So this is the game. That does not indicate you are stopping thoughts, but ultimately thoughts become null and void. And ultimately you can understand how much I suffered. Of course, you being 17, you are not much suffered. I am 70 years old. Imagine the way you'd have suffered without mindfulness. And once you become mindful, thoughts will come, just like passing clouds. But they never stay in the sky. They can't close the sun permanently. They can't close the moon permanently. They come and goes. And they are not brushing. They are not touching the sky. They're far below. So considering that, facing the thought is a very revolutionary. No one thought even that thoughts are something you can observe. So you are taking the distance from the observed and the observer, and that is the way you take it under control. So ultimately, pain also become a thought. Ultimately, perception also become a mental aspect. And your mental proliferation, or rather planning, intentions, volitional activities, and ultimately what you think, who am I? Also will be vulnerable and questionable. But don't rush. Just be with the thoughts, and your presentation is fairly good. And special attribution or special quality is that you are so young and still analytic. But I have to accept young people are much smarter than we old fellows. So therefore, please continue. And your reporting, I hope, will be intermediate understanding stage for the others, those who are participating in the discussion. So we are going to take another serious sutta, and Onaya, you may join us. And one thing I would like to, before go to the sutta, I would like to mention is Education Ministry issued the authoritative letter from the secretary, and yesterday director phoned us and talked. They have informed 318 directors and 90 zonal directors, 7 provincial directors. Satyapasali is the leading thing in the basically education reform, and therefore we are quite authoritative. We are going, and as you all know, master training program is underway. And presently we are presenting the second session, third sessions, like subgroup-wise. So don't worry about the subgroup. Just roll out master training 8 sessions, and then we know where are we. And I am about to make a progress report to the minister. He will appear in the next counseling meeting, and I may get another 3-4 minutes. And then I can thank him and the whole ministry. And we can let them know we have proceed, we have progress so much so, this is for your general understanding. So with that remark, I would like to invite Venerable Buddharakkhita to present the today's issue, please. Today's sutta, please.
Okay, so today is we start again a new sutta, and this one is called the octet of the, on the supreme, the Paramattaka Sutta. So the background of this sutta is that is a very famous story. Everybody knows it in Buddhism, and in fact, it's probably one of the most famous stories out of the Buddhist canon. Most people in the world have heard this story, and they don't know that actually this is coming from the Buddhist texts, but I was talking with Mahatero recently, and he suggested that it even predates Buddhism. Maybe it's a Brahmanic teaching that's been incorporated into Buddhism, or it was a previous story, a story prior to the time of the Buddha, but the Buddha adopted it and used it in the teachings. And it's the famous story of a king who is aggravated or annoyed by all the sectarian disputes that are going on around him. So various ascetics coming saying, my view is supreme. And then another one comes along and says, my view is supreme. And what he does is that he orders that several blind men be gathered and show them an elephant. And the king's men assemble the blind men and present them different parts of the elephant. And they're told to feel the elephant. And as they touch that particular part of the elephant, then the king asks them, what is an elephant like? And one who touches the trunk says that the elephant is like a pole of a plow. And those who touch the tusks and other parts revile him, dispute with that person's experience of the elephant. And they say, do not lie to the king. The elephant is like a peg in a wall, and so forth. After hearing them all, the king dismissed the sectarians, saying, your systems are just like this. So a certain monk was on alms round, and he heard this and reported it to the Blessed One. And this is taken as the origin of this sutta that we're going to discuss today, in which the bhikkhus say, just as blind men, not knowing what an elephant is like, dispute over the parts they have touched, so the sectarians, not knowing the Dhamma that cultivates in emancipation, sees this and that view and dispute over them. He then spoke this discourse to teach the Dhamma. So it's a very famous sutta, and I think many of us have heard it, or this story, but we haven't really thought carefully about what the Buddha had to say about this this famous incident. If you remember hearing this story about the elephant and the blind men and how they all got it all muddled up, we can now just listen to what the Buddha has to say about this, and it's quite astonishing, and not probably what you yourself would have come to the conclusion. So I ask you to listen very carefully to what the Buddha was saying. So starting now, settling on his own view as supreme amongst views, whatever a person esteems as best in the world, in comparison, he says, all others are inferior. Therefore, he has not transcended disputes. Whatever benefit one sees for oneself, in the seen, the heard, the sensed, or in good behavior and observances, having grasped hold of that alone, one regards all else as inferior. The skilled speak of that as a not. When one is attached and regards others as inferior, therefore a bhikkhu should not be attached to the seen, to the heard, or sensed, or to good behavior and observances, nor should one construct any view in the world by measures of knowledge or good behavior and observances. One should not take oneself as equal, or think of oneself as inferior or superior. having abandoned what is taken up, not clinging, one does not create a dependency even on knowledge, not taking sides amongst those who are divided. One does not fall back on any view at all. For one who has no wish here, for either end, for various states of existence here or beyond, there are no places of residence at all, grasped after deciding among teachings. Not even a subtle notion is formed by him about what is seen, heard, or sensed. How could anyone here in the world categorize him, that Brahman who does not cling to any view? They do not construct, they have no preferences. Even the teachings are not embraced by them. A Brahman cannot be led by good behavior and observances. The impartial one, gone beyond, does not fall back. So we're going to discuss this, and we need to be patient with ourselves, because this is a very profound sutta and not at all trivial, and take some twists and turns that are going to maybe defy our experience of the world. But the nature of wisdom is that it is paradoxical. So it is an apparent contradiction. So we're going to deal with some of these contradictions that are brought up by the Buddha, and we'll go through them. So he first dismantles this idea that people, various ascetics or teachers, that they settle upon their own as supreme amongst views. So in this day, of course, we're very aware that political leaders, religious leaders, extreme views are the fashion almost. I mean, but we can see that this fashion is very ancient. It goes back to the time of the Buddha, that one's own view is supreme. It is better than the other views. So left is superior to right, or right is superior to left, or authoritarian is superior to the more anarchistic view. Educated view is more superior to the uneducated view. The rich view is superior to the poor view. The poor view is superior to the rich view, and so on. We can see that this is infinite, and we can see that this ancient game that the human has played is continuing in just a new fashion today. We have changed so much in the world since the time of the Buddha, but you can see that the nature of human behavior is still the same. So settling on his own view as supreme amongst views, whatever a person esteems as best in the world, in comparison, he says all others are inferior. Therefore, he has not transcended disputes. So this final sentence in this stanza, therefore he has not transcended disputes, it means that we have not transcended disputes, means we will always be disputing, we'll always be in conflict, we will always be suffering, because we haven't transcended. So the Buddha here is not saying like dismiss views or ignore them or deny that they have any reality. He asks us to transcend the views. So we can be informed by the different views of different people, and we can be informed by our own biases, that we have preferences in those views, or that we're attracted to views, and maybe that tells us more about ourselves. Like I find myself that recently a friend of mine told me that they had voted for Brexit in the UK, and that their husband was mocking them about this. Their husband was would introduce his wife, saying this person voted for Brexit. Like, how foolish is my wife? And I thought this is quite ridiculous. Like, I mean, that they can make a joke about it, but at the same time, you know, the majority of people in England voted for Brexit. So it wasn't like his wife was holding an alien idea, and that the government that this person lives in now is a Brexit government, and so forth. So I can just say that even in the most personal arrangements, you know, we should understand that if you are a married couple, somebody has to sleep on the left side of the bed and somebody has to sleep on the right side of the bed, you know. So it's not an alien thing that people be left and be right. In fact, it may be very convenient. If everybody tries to sleep on the right side of the bed, then there's no room for anybody, or there's no... we're not taking in the different perspectives. We're like the blind people where the elephant is just a trunk, or the elephant is just the broom of the tail, or the elephant is just the tree trunk legs, or the elephant is some wall, the side of the wall. So we're not taking in the different perspectives of the world. And so I find myself, when I'm conflicted or when I'm challenged by some view that that maybe I'm disagreeing with it, then I like to slow myself down and be mindful that I'm having these feelings of rejection of that view, and that I need to sort of step back mentally and try to understand not just where is the other person coming from, but where am I coming from. And what is my conditioning around this view that I'm suddenly feeling is like attacking my understanding or my perception of the world? And this informs me very deeply of what it is that I value. So in the past, I would have been just maybe angry and affronted by somebody else's different perspective or view. Whereas now I'm much more patient and have the tools to grasp or at least begin to comprehend that other person's perspective and ask them more information so that I can maybe inform my view and maybe change or amend my view. So when I could, for instance, in this example that I gave about the husband and wife who vote differently, then I could really begin to understand like how difficult it was to be for that lady to be mocked as such, or be put down, be viewed as inferior by her husband over how she had voted in the election. And it wasn't that this person is stupid. She had considered her vote carefully and discussed it with various, you know, different people, and had come to a reasoned understanding about it. So I could feel the pain and the suffering that both people had, and you know, it's amazing how potent these views are. So we can see that this is the kindling for disputes to arise within families, for hurt to arise, because nobody wishes to be viewed as inferior. And nobody wishes to, you know, have to be made to recognize, oh, somebody else is superior. Or the one that annoys me the most is where we're all the same. I think if you look around, and you will see that nobody is the same. And it can be very interesting to talk to identical twins and how much they will like try to point out how they're not the same. You know, that even though they're identical twins, they will say, you know, my name is John and the other person is Michael. And you know, you have to say, I can't distinguish between John or Michael. And so you have to maybe ask, apologize, say, listen, look, if I get your names mixed up, and then maybe they'll tell you, yeah, even our mother doesn't recognize the difference between us at times. But I assure you, we are different, you know. I have different tastes, I like different music, I like different food, and so forth. So even down to identical twins, nobody is the same. So it's very deluded when you for me, whenever I hear somebody saying we're all the same, I know that it's incredibly deluded, because it is a supreme denial that we're all the same. So if we're not better than, if we're not the same as, and if we're not inferior, well, what are we? Well, the answer is we're all different. And this is a very profound insight, because whenever monks became enlightened, they didn't they didn't announce themselves to the Buddha as, you know, I am enlightened, or I am superior, or I am better than, or anything like that. What they would say is that this is unique, this is individual. So this was how they announced that they were enlightened. So this first stanza is incredibly deep and points the true direction that we should have. But at the same time, we have to acknowledge that this perspective that instantly arises, this what we call conceit, that I am the same as, I am better than, or I am inferior to, is a constant judgment that is happening in every interaction between every person, every being. So maybe you look at your dog and you love your dog, but you feel superior to your dog. Or you look at your children and you feel superior to your children. Well, I'm the parent. I know better. Or the child looks at the parents and kind of go, well, you know, my parents don't, they're not quite cool. They're out of date or something like that. And they're old fashioned or they're something else. So we can immediately see this judgment is constantly arising in our mind and in every interaction. So it takes a lot of mindfulness to be aware of this conceited nature. And we need to tackle it because the problem is arising within our own heart. But maybe this is just the first stanza, and maybe Venerable Mahathera might like to add or share his perspective.
So I have a practical involved issue. I am not getting involved, but I have to answer. So last few weeks I talked personally with Venerable Buddha Rakhita, and he told this sutta will be a source book, source for that kind of a thing or resolution. The issue is the climatic effect, or how people look at the climate. And some people are quite excited because there are a lot of waves, a lot of heat waves, and sea waves, fire, cyclones. And last few years they were talking about the human beings are destroying the climate or environment or the forest. So therefore they predicted 2035, we are going to feel the consequences. But later they told, no, 227, you may see early signs because escalating rate, we are destroying the environment. Now we are still in 2021, and some places are very prominent, and even in the forest we can feel changes, at least ideas of the people. So the issue regarding the environment or the forest, and how is your view? And Venerable suggested to compare it with view is the, you have taken a view regarding the forest and it must not be touched, it must be completely preserved and 100% for the forest is for the sake of forest. The other part is the craving, you rob, you kill, you cut the forest and open, ripped open, and then earn as much as possible. So Paramattaka Sutta is giving the view aspect of the issue. And the other aspect is the loggers. They don't care. They just want to get the maximum whether the environment is protected or not. They may know sometime that before 2025-35 they will die and the environment will be finished. And before that, why not get some money and throw a party and be happy? A lot of dopamine hormones, and they may be pragmatic from their point of view. But from the environmental point of view, world point of view, from the Paramattaka Sutta point of view, you have to have two extremes. One thing is, view-wise, you will say, don't enter into the forest. It must be completely preserved. 100% forest is for the sake of forest. That is what we attributed as the view-wise, they get mixed up. And they have to utterly fight with the other people. They are cutting, robbing, ripping open and finishing the forest. I am talking a little bit towards Sri Lanka. And American corn belt, they completely destroyed. Amazon forest, they completely destroyed. And recently I heard in Thailand, they are opening like anything. In Malaysia, they are growing, but ultimately the contours of the natural forest and the everything gone, I come to the macro level agricultural projects. Every land is flat and irrigation, and everything is mechanized. Easy way of handling the trees, crop I mean, and destroying the natural environment or called biodiversity. So when that kind of a thing happened from the Paramattaka Sutta point of view, what is the role of the forest monk? If someone is telling, no, you can't go there because forest monk is a cancer, he is destroying the forest, and so much so. We had 485 acres and prepared the kutis and everything for 15 monks. Of course, for the last 50 years or so, it has increased up to 30 monks. We have all the complete features for the forest. And recently in the discussion, the view people, those who have taken view, came and measured, and they told, we have opened 4 acres, so we have destroyed the 4 acres because we have prepared walking paths. We have prepared open areas, and we have put up buildings, so therefore they are very happy to take all the monks into the forest, out of the forest, and give 4 acres land in a village, and please get out. Please mind your own business. You have destroyed 4 acres. And luckily it came up, and others can understand 60 years, 30 monks lived and protected 485 acres, and they used walking and sitting 4 acres. And the forestry people, I would say the view people, from my point of view, they say, no, that is a destruction. Not only for our Nisarnavani, it's all over in Sri Lanka. So I just managed to take that issue in the Presidential Council in the last this thing. I told the Aboriginal people live in the forest, completely cut off. They have to get permission even to touch a roof. And Chena cultivation people, they lived in the forest and prepared the vegetable lands. It's completely prohibited. And the lucky enough, they were not aware there are monks called forest monks. It case was handled individually. They are filing a case against a particular forest monastery or monk, telling this and that. And now it has come to the national level. And there we can understand this kind of view people. People take the view. They are taking so much of theoretical issues, something like deadlock principle. Once a log is fallen, it must die and decarbonate on the spot. We must not even take for firewood. And therefore, we are prohibited to take firewood to live in the forest. We are adopting. Other parties, the authoritarian people sometimes give 1,000 acres for just to fell the trees and use for firewood and the timber. We have nothing to say, and everyone knows in Sri Lanka. So what is the role of the forest monk? And relationship they wanted to find, that is UN. United Nations, they wanted to find the relationship at last, the relationship between the forestry balance and the mindfulness. Appear like far away two issues, and they have asked the Buddhist perspective. And UN appointed, and they have the COP, COP, yeah. 26. Yeah. And it's going to happen in this month. Yeah. And lucky enough, the Lama and myself is being appointed to chair the conference, and we are about to give our perspective, then how the view-grasping people just be in the air-conditioned rooms and on the rotating chairs, and they are writing constitutions and filing cases, all the kind of thing. They don't know how the forest life is. And the other parties, they don't care about the forest conservation ordinance or nothing. They use the power and destroy the forest. And what is the role of a forest monk? And we are better off because we already started mindful school, mindful family. Now it is our duty to see the relationship between the mindfulness or the mental environment and how much it is in return help regulate the environment, not to bias to the tanha or the craving, what is the balance. So therefore, Paramattaka Sutta is a good set of tools to understand how to balance it. So I am taking each and every note because I am preparing myself. So I am again passing the ball to Venerable Buddharakkhita. If someone also wish to have some that kind of provocative ideas and good thoughts, welcome.
So, yeah, and so the next verse is, whatever benefit one sees for oneself in the seen, the heard, the sensed, or in good behavior and observances, having grasped hold of that alone, one regards all else as inferior. So the crux of this sentence here is having grasped hold of that alone. And it's just very natural. I've just seen it in my own development that it's just the nature when we grow up, wherever we grow up, we're fed a certain perspective of the world, the perspective of our family, the perspective of our clan, the perspective of our village or our area, our country. And we grasp hold onto that identity or that view, and we hold that alone. Now, not many people are like me or like Mahatero, who have spent a lot of time in different parts of the world and had the opportunity to become, you know, have an intimate, you know, sharing of other people's perspectives or views, where we get challenged into our own sort of singular view of the world. So, for instance, I grew up, eating food with a fork and a knife and a spoon. And when I moved to, say, living in Singapore or in Malaysia, the first thing I had to learn was how to use a chopstick. And luckily, the person who trained me in how to use a chopstick was very good, and he could explain it very clearly and was very patient and a good teacher. And I learned to enjoy eating with a chopstick. And then I had to learn how to eat with my hands. And even to this day, I'm not very skillful at eating with my hands. When I see some people who have been eating with their hands since they were a baby, then I can see how much more skillful they are. Like, I will drop food and have food smeared all over my hand. It's and I'm not totally messy. I'm not unskillful. I'm just saying it's. I recognize that I can still improve. And then in Malaysia, you would eat with a fork and a spoon. You didn't eat with a knife. And in Chinese culture, they believe eating with a knife is like, why would you bring weapons to the table? You know, how uncivilized. And so forth. And I remember I was eating Indian food with my father, and he was eating with a fork and a knife. And as you know, eating a curry with a fork is not very useful. And I was eating with my hands. And afterwards, he was very upset because he said I shouldn't be eating with my hands, that it wasn't civilized. So we can see that once we are conditioned into a way of living, and we grasp hold of that alone. So we grasp hold of the fork and the knife. We grasp hold of eating with our hands. We grasp hold of eating with chopsticks. And but the amazing thing I was reflecting on this is that there's not many other ways we eat. You know, like some people like eating food like an astronaut from a toothpaste squeezer. But there's really not many ways we have of eating in the world. And it's amazing how we can struggle with the three or four different ways we have of eating. So I'm just giving you this as a kind of a concrete example of how few ways, in fact, the world does things, and yet we can really dispute with each other about these things. And this, when it spreads out into views, it becomes infinite. Just as Mahathera was talking about the view, the ideology around the environment versus, we'll say, the craving aspect around the world, around the environment, that it needs to be productive or useful or profitable or, you know, of benefit to society or something like that, where it's just viewed in very accounting terms. Or like we have this view where it becomes like Mother Earth, like a religious kind of denotation to it. And it becomes a sort of sacred and something that's so holy that we can't touch it or we can't have any interaction with it. You know, we have these extreme views and everything else in between. And we fail to understand that there's many ways of grasping the world. There are many aspects to the world. And that if we hang on too much to the trunk or to the tusks or to the tail or to the legs of the world, we fail to see all the different components that go into the world, but also our own blindness, our own inability to see the different perspectives and to have that openness of mind. But also, as we will later discover in this sutta, you know, the fundamental nature that things are not as they seem. So this having grasped hold of that alone, one regards all else as inferior. And here, when you see the word inferior, you have to mentally substitute inferior, superior, or the same as. You know, so it's going to be one of those three different perspectives that we take in basically everything. And in the West, when I was growing up, of course, there was superior and inferior. But this relationship around the same as well is much more clearly explained here in Buddhism. And even inferiority, like I might think I'm very humble, that I'm not superior to somebody else. But from a Buddhist perspective, is like taking on this perspective or this role of being inferior is also a distortion. And you can say it's as bad as being superior is to be inferior. So it's very difficult if I say to somebody, you know, normally in Asia, they will say, You need to be modest. You're shameful if you're proud or something like that. So you can get really pushed down into being inferior. You might think, well, I only know how to be inferior. I don't know how to, as they say in the West now, establish my boundaries. You know, so I always have to take on the inferior role. But it's a kind of a superior role. You know, in Christianity, they also talk about like the rich man will never get into heaven, no more than can pass through than a camel can pass through the eye of a needle or something like that. So in every culture, if you know, there's a view that superiority is not good. But here we can see that one should also not take on the inferior perspective. So it becomes very complicated. If I'm not superior, if I'm not inferior, and if I'm not the same, you know, well, what am I? And, you know, it comes back to this point about being actually individual and treating every situation as it arises in the moment, rather than having predetermined perspectives and views that blind us to how the world is in that very present moment in time. Maybe Mahathera can continue. And
no, you gave so much of a broad aspect. I wish to know the mindfulness versus forest, mindfulness versus environment, and you made 2-3 statements specifically on that, and may not be directly we are going to the Paramattaka Sutta, but we may be going parallel with, and it says whenever you get ditthi, whenever you get views, you are blindfolded, you never see the practical side of it. When you are going to cut the forest and destroy the environment, the rich people will destroy it, everyone has to suffer. So there is no balance. And what is the perspective of a forest monk? What we have to say about the Ditti people as well as for the exploiters, foresters, deforesters, fellas? You have any because it's an island, is a good good fella chopping trees.
Well, you know, it's really difficult, you know, this whole environmental or sustainable movement, because it has become so heavily bound up in views that it becomes extremely difficult to have a discussion about environmental or sustainability or about how we use the resources in the world, how we share the resources, the natural resources in the world, how we share them between people and how we share them with other beings, and how we have this paradox that is arising in this sutta, that I am not superior, I'm not inferior, I'm not the same, and so I am an individual. You know, this person is unique. And then we have to balance this with we are interbeing, inter-are, as Thich Nhat Hanh describes it. This interrelationship between all of the individuals. So in the Buddhist teachings, we have this very lively, very very alive sort of paradox that this person speaking is an aggregate, is a bunch of aggregates, is sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and thinking happening, thoughts arising in the mind, speech happening, and yet this aggregate is unique, wonderful, and special, and yet this aggregate is also interbeing, inter-are, is in relationship between the self and the world. And the Buddha is saying that the problem is arising within me, and the solution is also arising within me, and that this is the universe inside my skin. Yet this skin, this body, exists within the world. And for me, the challenge as a monk is like, okay, I can hide away in the forest and be by myself, but I'm also not. There are certain kinds of defilements that only arise when I meet other people. And so I need to meet other people to, in a way, expose those defilements so that I can see the different points of view that I'm holding alone and realize that there are other views, there are other ways that are different to this unique, wonderful, and special, and realize that, oh, okay, you know, who I am is just a sort of a bunch of views and tanhas, cravings, that are just fluid, and I need not hold on to any particular position, and I just need to be more open and fluid to those perspectives. So it becomes really challenging when you face into this idea of the forest. So for instance, we had this forestry officer who has fined us and all this for lifting logs, our dead trees that have fallen on our footpaths and so forth, as damaging the forest. But what that person didn't see is that this forest around us is only 60 years old. So this forest, it's not that the monks have knocked down 4 acres of forestry to create our buildings, but the forest has grown up around the monastery. This forest didn't exist before the monastery, or it was maybe scrub or something like that. But you can see, in fact, all the trees and all the plants are less than the age of the forest or of the monastery. So we didn't remove four acres. We grew 400 acres around the monastery, you know. But this person thinks we subtracted from the forest. In fact, we were the seed for the forest, and we are the protectors of the forest. And the forest around the monastery is the best forest in this area, because all of the village people don't take most of the plants from this area. There's some very very valuable trees that they will come in and steal, but otherwise they leave the rest. So the animals, the creatures, everything here is very pristine. So this blind view that we are damaging the forest or that we are, you know, destroying it by living here is not correct. You know, it's not substantiated by fact. So this view is being blinded. But, you know, it's a very complex dance between how we live in the forest and not damage the forest and be beneficial to the forest, because we are changing the forest. Even by our presence here, we change the forest too. So this is life. Life is complicated. Life is challenging. Life is difficult. You know, and the underlying principles in this sutta is how we need to watch how we form views. Because no matter what it is, it's, in this case, we're talking about environmental or in forest terms, but this applies across all of life. It can be around school, it can be around politics, it can be around business, it can be around eating habits. In every way, this Paramatta Sutta is like a very profound sutta underlining the underlining mechanisms and physics of every human interaction in every situation.
Okay, that I may be too much pulling the attention to the environmental issue. I would say that at the beginning they have managed to take 100 acres, but it was an extraordinary offer. And then after a few years, they complained. They got complaints and they visited the place and found it's completely falsified. And ultimately, out of happiness, they offered 385 other acres. And that is kind of a sustainability and understanding, and not on a view. A forest office came here, established the office and gave 385. After that, after a while, carbon trade and carbon exchange came, and the minister told, no, we need all everything back. And I was a little resistant, but they have the power. So it happened me to sign this thing. They gave 28 acres. That is the place where all the buildings are there. And then only the very vehement fight started, telling that we have to protect the whole forest. If we are ever felling happened, they come and lodge complaints and kind of thing. So they are now, they have taken, I took time to see the constitution and the kind of thing. They are never happy to think twice. They think it must be restricted more and more rather than relaxing. Then I invited them, why don't we include forest monks or monasteries? Never. And then the view and the craving part came. Still there were some fillings outside the places. I am talking to the very specific case. Maybe it is some people get hurt and they were not happy. But recently, I raised the issue, now they are going to consider the forest monks or forest monastic ordinance how to cater into the Sri Lankan forest. Mahaveli is catered for. Low-lying area development is catered, but now forest also. Therefore, we have a role model. We are living in the forest. We are not biased by the view, not biased by the craving, and we are doing. And as you mentioned, the question and answer is within. That is the point where mindfulness comes into being. And when we are meditating, when we are doing, and thank you, the issue you raised that forest is maximum is 70 years. That means forest preserved due to the monastery. And Thailand is a very good example. Wherever forest monks are there,
wherever there's forest monks.
Yeah, forest monks.
You cannot take them apart anymore. If you see a forest in Thailand, you know it's a monastery.
So that's a all. Very good sound example. But view people, grasped by the view, they say, monks are the main threat to the forest. But they themselves are ignorant about felling due to the political influences and other economical influences. So now UN, United Nations, they have taken the issue and they have thought about to see the relationship between the Buddhism or mindfulness with the forest, as well as you mentioned one day, even the politician, even the economist and the socialist people, they don't have ideas. The Buddha, before 2,500 years ago, he balanced it. He never thought about the Nisarnavane and the forest, 385, 485 acres. He told the new ideas to come because of the dialogue.
But even if you look in our rules, for instance, it says that that monks are allowed to backburn a forest in front of a fire. So normally you think monks, we shouldn't, it's very strong in our rules, we shouldn't damage a branch. You know, we really go to extremes with plants and not harming plants. And so when lay people come to the monastery, they have to, we have to ask them to do any damage to plants. We can't cut them down. We can't even move branches out of our way. You know, it's extreme, actually, in Theravada Buddhism. I mean, I'm not saying it in a bad way. I'm just saying how strongly the monks will protect and not damage or injure a plant. But we're allowed in the vinaya to backburn. If there's a forest fire, we can burn an area around the forest, the monastery, to protect the monastery. And this was very important as an exemption, because in Australia, we had a lot of problems with fires and arson, and we had to do a lot of fire control. So even we still didn't burn things as monks. We would work with the lay people. But there was always that exemption in the vinaya that we could do backburning. So the Buddha really understood that we had to balance our relationship. And really, this is the problem, like Mahatero is presenting question today about how we can relate environmentally with the world. But the answer isn't easy. You know, it's not going to be black and white. As the Buddha is telling us clearly, it's not black and white. It's not preserve everything, protect everything, don't touch anything. And it's not just rape and pillage. It's in fact, it's unfortunately complicated. It's unfortunately difficult. It's unfortunately, you're going to have to be very careful around having views and attitudes that you're not superior, you're not inferior, and you're not the same, and that we're all different, and we are inter-being and inter-are. And it's so that takes wisdom and maturity. We can teach children black and white things, but as we get older and more mature, we have to learn that the world is a multicolored place. It's a rainbow. And we are not alone in the world. We are interacting with the world, and we should hopefully leave more benefit behind than we took. But we will have to take from the world, and hopefully we will return to the world, and hopefully we will cultivate wisdom more than just simply plants and animals in the world or people in the world. The goal of Buddhism is to cultivate wisdom, not plants and animals. So, you know, I do find these ideologues or these people who are very vehement about one view or the other view, that it's all about, you know, making money, or it's all about, you know, preserving the wilderness, you know, as just kind of extreme people. And they can be very boring to talk to because they only have one view. And I'm looking at the world going, the world is a multitude, just as I am a multitude. If somebody says to me, oh, you know, you white fellows, you're all the same. Like, this is what I'm told constantly. I'm a white fellow and I'm all the same. And, you know, I share this monastery with other so-called white people. One is actually Chinese, Vietnamese. And another one is a white American. But, you know, we are all completely different. You know, we are completely different. And sometimes when I'm in a big city, we'll just say London, and I see white people. But when I listen to them speaking, I understand, oh, this one is from Europe. This one is from the Eastern Europe. This one is a tourist from, you know, some place, maybe South Africa or, you know, we're all completely different. We just look white. Just as when I meet brown people, we'll just say brown, like they could be, you know, Indian, they can be anywhere, who knows. You meet yellow people, and I've spent a lot of time with yellow people, and they're like, wow, they're all completely different. And I enjoy that difference. I enjoy that getting to know the individual and getting to know the person. And that takes a little bit of extra effort than just saying we're all the same. And I think it just takes a little bit more maturity. So it's not simple. That's all.
Okay, now it is time is passing. So I would like to take the same issue. If you have any comments, please help me. And to summarize Venerable's talk last episode, the Buddha explained about the patagi. Patagi is the backfire. And that I learned from the scouting. And then I saw it in Australia. And they saw I saw the mechanism there. As Venerable Buddha Rakita mentioned, even a green leaf, even a living branch, even we can spit upon, we can urinate upon, we can shit upon, that is also being scrutinized. But whenever the fire happens, you have to set the fire from a dwelling place towards the fire. That is called patagi, backfire. That's a very clear indication how much the monk must be aware of the living forest, not to damage in the normal day-to-day run, but a forest fire is happening, monk, he may be the rescuing, and he may be setting a fire, small with the small burnable things, and then set the fire to go forward. And that is exactly explained how the craving, how the desire, how the lust can be tackled, patagi. So that is the way the mindfulness is coming to be. The second thing is, I would like to introduce, but I invite you to come with the next day, the system approach and the particle approach. Scientifically, they are taking particles, individuals, trunk or the tusk or the leg, and they are expert on that. But they don't know, they don't see the elephant. But the system approach is for the religious. They are concerned about the next life and the merits and the skillfulness and everything. And the science appears like a threat to the specifically the God believers. But Buddhism, in between, they can easily entertain the science, easily entertain the other religious also, and can give something. So therefore, system approach, we can say for the elders, scientific approach is for the youngsters. But when you grow, you have to understand both. With that remark, I would like to sum up today's discussion. And if you have any ideas over the next week, please share with us. With that remark, I am going to sum up. Thank you very much for the participation.